Don't you succumb. I want to urge you to get a copy of my book, Renewing the Soul of America. As we're looking here at a period of patriotic days coming up here, important in the history of our country, you need to equip yourself with this information. Pastors have used this book all across the country, over 650 endnotes. It is an absolute wealth of information, Renewing the Soul of America. It's a $17 book, but for your gift of $12 or more to Save America Ministries, we want to put it in your hands. Just call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA. Get it on our website, saveus.org. Renewing the Soul of America, one person at a time, beginning with you. It's going to set forth the vision, the godly vision for us. Let's walk in it. God bless you. Be a blessing. And remember, get Renewing the Soul of America and pray for our nation, friends. We might fulfill God's holy purpose.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IR and its advertisers or affiliates.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Constance Cumby, who's a lawyer, practices in Detroit, but she is certainly the primary expert and authority on the New Age movement, it's a Luciferian movement intent upon bringing about a world government and the destruction of Christianity. Well, you know, if you look at what's going on in the world today, an awful lot of things just don't really make sense. We find that Iran is actually announcing that it's a triple the number of centrifuges it's going to be using. Centrifuges it's going to be using to develop enriched uranium. Now, certainly there's no question at all that Iran is trying to build a nuclear bomb. And we know that because, of course, they're getting their enriched uranium right now from Russia. Russia's supplying all that they need for their nuclear power plant. So Very obviously, Iran is planning on building a nuclear bomb, but why would you make an announcement? You know, certainly they know that the United States is just looking for an excuse to attack. Israel's looking for an excuse to attack. So why would rational people give either the United States or Israel certainly a justification for an attack? It just doesn't make sense. Why does President Ahmadinejad of Iran, make so many foolish statements like we're going to just wipe the Zionist state out, or we're going to destroy the great Satan, or America's going to be destroyed? Why would any logical person do such a thing? And I'd like to suggest we're not dealing with logical people. I believe we're dealing with people who are being energized by forces that over which they have no control, because everything is pointing to the fact that there's going to be a war with Iran sooner or later. I don't know. But it's going to be coming about. America, President Bush, Cheney is looking for a justification for war. Israel is looking for a justification for war. And the Iranian leaders are giving them every justification. It doesn't make sense unless there's another force there, unless there's an X factor. And I realized this many years ago. I've been studying what's going on for, well, ever since 1962. And as you begin to evaluate what's going on in the world, and you see all the unfolding forces and what the communists were doing and what the Council on Foreign Relations was doing and what the great tax-exempt foundations were doing, and as time and again they would work to actually cause nation after nation to fall to communism, it didn't make any sense. Why would capitalists be doing everything they could to help the communists until you become aware of the fact that there is an X factor, and that's this issue of the New Age, these spiritual forces that Constance Cumby talks about. So without further ado, Constance, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks again for the invitation, Dr. Monteith.
So basically, I thought maybe we could talk about your interpretation of what's going on in light of certainly prophecies that certainly these people on the other side, Javier Solana and the others, who seem to have a different worldview. They seem to be intent upon bringing about this world government and, of course, the destruction of Christianity. And so why don't you just give us your thoughts, and we'll just go through that this evening. What do you think is happening? And
I think what's happening may very well be just plain prophetic fulfillment. And I also think that that they may not see themselves as fulfilling prophecy, that in their scoffing and their usurpation of roles that belong to God, or their intent to secularize, as Javier Solana has scoffed at, worried about the United States being religiously driven, that they fail to recognize that they themselves could be the very prophetic fulfillment that they are scoffing.
Okay, you go right ahead.
Okay. There's an interesting New Age book I looked at it was a 1981 book, and it was written before the New Agers thought they had any serious opposition. And it was written by an English esotericist who was connected with Findhorn Foundation, who kept his finger on the pulse of what was happening in the New Age movement. He wrote at least three books that I'm aware of. One was on pyramids, another one was Beyond All Belief, which is his middle book. But his the book that interested me the most was The Armageddon Script by Peter Le Mesurier. And it was 1982, and Le Mesurier had he also wrote a book called Cosmic Code, I believe, which was written with permission from the Findhorn Foundation. And they had allowed him to quote from his earlier book that he had written for their Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E, which was interesting in and of itself, because that was the same name as Hitler's super secret group. And Le Mesurier said, hey, we've got these prophecies out there, and they are going to, as long as they're hanging around in people's expectation and people are expecting fulfillment of them, they're going to occur. This is going to occur at some inconvenient time with all these expectations out there. So we should go ahead and stage our own fulfillment at a time that is more convenient to us. And he said, since there's no possibility of their being fulfilled literally, then let's stage one at a convenient time. It's going to be convenient to us and won't mess things up. And he called, he laid out a scenario in intense detail, which pretty much fit in with the things that I had studied on the New Age movement. It was clear that he had studied prophecies, and he said that there were many others doing so. And he wrote about it, and he said that one of the things that interested me, he said they wouldn't have to worry about the old agers, that the masked forces of the old age would go on to defeat each other in a massive mutual venting of long pent-up aggression. His conclusion of the book was one of the most astounding things I've ever read in my life, and I've quoted this before and even on your program. He said, their script is now written, subject only to last-minute editing and stage directions. The stage itself, albeit as yet in darkness, is almost ready. Down in the pit, the subterranean orchestra is already tuning up.
I want you to hold that thought, because we're going to bring all of our stations back on board in just a moment here. Well, certainly, Constance has been quoting a book by Peter, I think, Lemessurier,
Lemessurier.
And he was a New Age writer, and he's talking about certainly these prophecies of the Christians about the, and so they were going to go ahead and stage something that would actually bring about the things that the Christians were anticipating. And so he writes in this book, and he talks about how everything is in place. And I want you to pick up the quotation there, that what he writes back about 1980, about what lies
1981.
Ahead. 1981.
He might have written a little bit earlier, but it was released in 1981. So their script is now written, subject only to last-minute editing and stage directions. The stage itself, albeit as yet in darkness, is almost ready. Down in the pit, the subterranean orchestra is already tuning up. The last-minute walk-on parts are even now being filled. Most of the main actors, one suspects, have already taken up their roles. Soon it will be time for them to come on stage, ready for the curtain to rise. The time for action will have come.
And, of course, what they're talking about is these prophetic things that the Christians are anticipating, but they're going to help to bring them about.
They were going to stage one, and they were going to be able to enlist all kinds of people in this. They would be able to unify the various youth groups of the world. For example, page 237, in Time for Action, he said, the new mission to the youth of the world, then, will be an international movement dedicated to spreading the already developing ideas and values upon which the New Age is to be founded. Those ideas and values will not necessarily be the traditional Christian ones, but for the wisdoms of all ages and cultures will be called upon to surrender their most precious secrets, and the collective human psyche will add to it yet further wisdoms that have so far never even been expressed. That it is for the soul of man that the new David, capital N, capital D, will have to fight, and for a vision which runs counter in almost every way to the established religions, philosophies of the great world powers of the day. He may well have to pursue his struggle amidst a time of turmoil such as the world has never seen.
A time of turmoil such as the world has never seen.
Never seen.
Now, these people, you have to understand, they tie into people at the upper echelons of our government. They tie into the people in the esoteric and secret societies. They tie to these people of great wealth because, of course, these people are all working towards the same goal, and many of them are energized knowingly or unknowingly by these supernatural forces that have given them their great wealth and given them their great power and prestige, but, of course, at the cost of their eternal souls.
What's so interesting about Lemessurier, if I could, Dr. Stan, was that he had direct ties to the entire New Age movement. His book, The Cosmic Code, is just as open. He was into all this, all the occult things. He really did not believe these things would happen. And that may be that because he rejected God, God does turn people over to delusion. This book was 1981, copyrighted by him in 1981, but he had quoted from some earlier things that he had written. And the book of Daniel said the wise would understand what was happening. Said none of the wicked would even understand. And so these guys are out there saying, gee, we'd better do this because there are people expecting that this would happen. So they've studied us like anthropologists. They're tremendous projects. One was the Fundamentalism Project out of the University of Chicago, edited by Martin Marty. And a couple of those large tomes from those folks, there were about five of them. One was destroyed in a flood we had in our basement in a year before they put the sewer project in. At any rate, they've studied us. They figured out how to dissect us, how to pit fundamentalist groups off against each other. You're allowed to have a religion in their new world order. You're just not allowed to believe it's true. And they've been planning for a new synthesized religion that will, like when the Surrier said that all the wisdoms would contribute to it. And we've seen this take place now. They're actually putting that one into effect very aggressively in the form of Alliance of Civilizations. In fact, a young man he's young to me, middle-aged man in Wisconsin, but young to me and young to you, I suspect. Richard Peterson of Medford has quite a blog spot up on the internet with some tremendous material on the Alliance of Civilizations, which I've written about on the internet also. And his blog spot is called A Time and Times and Half a Time. And the vehicle and what they are putting in place, people who have given up on God, given up on religion for a time, are being put in positions where they're almost turned into figures worthy of worship themselves by UN with interesting music in the background music and soft voices playing. And giving their pitch, and these same people that say they're setting this thing up for peace and love, 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 are coming down in the harshest of tones against Christian believers, against Jewish believers, against sometimes even Muslim believers, and openly inciting the rest of the world to hatred of us. And saying that they are going to establish a code that every church must accept, every synagogue must accept, every mosque must accept, every religious school must accept. And they want to build a new universal creed, and the same folks doing this, who have one notable name is Karen Armstrong, and who has been written about in very flattering terms as being a genius and expert in the field of world religions. She doesn't even come close, but some of the folks in academic circles are saying that she is, even though the mistakes in her book are blatant and obvious. And they are rushing on this, and they are actually putting teeth into the Alliance of Civilizations and getting many governments to support it, including but not limited to our USA government.
And, of course, what you're really seeing is this desire for one religion for the entire world.
They're building a new world religion. Right. And she said that what you have to do in this new code is that they have to move beyond tolerance. They indeed have to move beyond respect, that we have to move into appreciation and love of each other's religions. And that was what the New Agers said they were going to accomplish back when I first started looking over them. One book that had synthesized many things, Signs of Christ by Harold Balyaz. It came out of a place in California, not too terribly far from you, I suspect, Agoura, California. I don't know if that's closer to the southern part or closer to where you live in Northern California, but he said that basically in the New Age, the theme would not be blessed be my God. The theme in the New Age would be blessed be thy God. And that everybody would worship everybody else's God in the pantheon, and those who refused would be labeled as troublemakers, and that there would be destruction of the old forms.
And, of course, this is really why I believe they've infiltrated the Christian faith. They've changed our music. They've changed the message of our churches. And of course, what the current Christian administration is doing is discrediting Christianity. I mean, if you were living over in some other country and you saw the pictures of what happened at Abu Ghraib, and believe me, they never would have released those pictures. They never would have gotten out if the people at the highest echelons of our government didn't want them out to discredit Christianity and to undermine the faith of the people throughout the world and what we traditionally hold. Everything we're doing in the way of torture and all of this material coming out is aimed at discrediting Christianity. After all, we have a Christian regime in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people are saying, if that's Christianity, I don't want anything to do with it. So we can understand then why they were so anxious, of course, to rig the election in 2004 in Ohio and many of the other states, and use of the electronic voting machines to get a professed Christian, George Bush, into the White House, who is effectively undermining faith in Christianity throughout the world. So certainly you can see the two prongs. One is the move towards world government. The other is the destruction of Christianity. Would that be a fair appraisal?
That's the Christianity, and they have in mind they also would like to destroy the Jews. They'd like to destroy the Christians, and they would even like to destroy the Muslims, because all three to them represent peoples of the book. This is interesting, because there are the early days of theosophy. They set up an esoteric Christianity section. And it was not Christianity. It was apostasy in the worst way. But they were so hell-bent on erasing Christ and erasing God that they even wanted to remove their esoteric Christianity section when they were convinced it was time for Krishnamurti to make his appearance as their new Messiah. And that's how deeply the hatred of Christianity went. Even though it was apostasy, they wanted to erase anything that remotely reminded them.
And, of course, only by understanding these occult forces can you understand why the Supreme Court took God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. The Supreme Court justices knew exactly what they were doing and what was going to end up down the road as we move from being a Christian nation to a post-Christian nation, and now increasingly into the next step, which is, of course, embracing the occult, embracing the supernatural, and the very real supernatural forces that are out there working to claim the souls of men. Well, go right ahead, Constance.
Well, what's interesting, a few years ago, some friends of mine in California, in San Jose, fought some blatant pagan statuary coming into town, a very important project to the New Agers, representing what a prophecy that they have. They're looking towards the year 2012 and what they call the return of Quetzalcoatl. And so some statuary was built with public funds in San Jose, California. And some friends of mine decided they were going to legally battle this. One was Sylvia Beadleston, and who I've lost track of over the years, by the way. If she's out there listening anywhere, I would love to hear from her. But they challenged this in federal court, and the Ninth Circuit, which I believe is your circuit in California, basically struck it down, and the United States Supreme Court refused to review it. And basically, well, they said, hey, this is cultural, so anything dealing with this is cultural, this is not religion. So basically, they allowed the enshrinement of the bloodthirsty pagan gods while banishing God the Father, while banishing God the Son, while banishing any influence of the Holy Spirit.
And, of course, we see this in our schools in California today, where, of course, the children will be asked to come to school dressed in Muslim garb to pray to Allah, to read the Quran. But could you imagine them, of course, being encouraged to pray to Jesus Christ or to read the Bible in our schools?
Are they asking children to come to school now? And has that actually happened in California?
Oh, yes. They were dressed up as Muslims. They were to pray to Allah, and they were, of course, to read the Quran. And there are some parents who object to
this. This is Alliance of Civilizations-type material.
Sure.
Not that they're in love with the Quran either, but they basically want to force breakdown barriers. They want to desensitize people, and they want to acclimate the children to praying to anything and anybody.
Of course, anything but Christianity. And when people understand that there is this intense hatred of Christianity, then, of course, we begin to understand what motivates the people at the highest levels of our government and within our courts in their attack on Christianity. So it's really a spiritual battle, isn't it, Constance, rather than a political or ideological battle?
It is a spiritual battle. It also is ideological. And it also has shades of politics. It's like the worst blending of all three. It's like the old pantheon in Roman times, which was all three of the above, political, religious, and spiritual. But it was a line that Christians dared not cross then if they valued their eternal souls, and it's a line we dare not cross now if we value ours.
Well, I think, of course, it should be increasingly clear, at least to our listeners of our program, the spiritual component that's present. Unless you understand that, nothing makes sense. What the Iranians are doing doesn't make any sense. What our leaders are doing, because it's bankrupting our country, doesn't make any sense. We're talking now somewhere between $3 and $5 trillion for this war. Joseph Stiglitz has written a book called The $3 Trillion War, but he says he thinks that Iraq and Afghanistan will cost us $4 or $5 trillion before it's all over. $3 trillion is very conservative. I mean, our entire national debt today, you know, is $9 trillion, a little over $9 trillion. Where are we going to be able to get the money?
I don't know if the money. It looks like
Hold that thought just a moment. Hold it just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was just simply saying that if you look at things from a logical point of view, whether the massive cost of the war in Iraq may even go up to $5 trillion, according to Professor Joe Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, looking at what America is doing, talking about expanding the war and bringing the wrath of the whole Muslim world down upon us, or certainly what the Iranians are doing in the way of trying to give us an excuse to go to war. None of this makes any sense unless there's another factor out there, and I believe that's the spiritual factor we're talking about, which is planning the next great war. Go right ahead, Constance.
Okay, well, interestingly enough, there are esoteric branches of all these religions, and Benjamin Krem had said that their so-called Maitreya would be the Imam Mahdi to the Muslims, and he'd be the Messiah to the Jews and the Christians, and he would be Buddha to the reincarnation of Maitreya Buddha to the Buddhists, and Krishna to the Hindus. But there is an interesting thing that Ahmadinejad, the prime minister of our president, I don't remember if he's prime minister or president, one of the other.
I think he's president. Because
president of Iran believes, and they have this bright, I think they call it bright shining movement, and they are expecting somebody to come and establish a kingdom and lead them, which is playing frighteningly into New Age scenarios
now. That's the Mahdi. They think the Mahdi is going to come.
Imam Mahdi, but they're expecting. And then there's an American Indian version of it, and that's been popping up a lot and talked about by a lot of people, that the true white brother will come from the East, and he's going to look over what's happened here and then ask people, did they do these things to you? And then they're going to have war on all those who have the sign of the cross and behead those with the sign of the cross, and then go on to build their new golden age. And it is the mirror image opposite of the prophecy in Revelation, where John said he saw the souls of those beheaded for the faith of Jesus and the testimony of God. And it, and what is so interesting, devilishly interesting on this thing is how it is the mirror image opposite of what we believe. They believe that their role on this earth is to fulfill and the script, very scriptures that they are scoffing at.
Yes, I really believe that that is absolutely true.
These scriptures don't exist. These scriptures are not true. We're delusional for reading them. We're delusional for believing them. At the same time, they've got a scenario where they are, they whether they realize it or not, seeking to fulfill. And there are people that have recognized that. I know Benjamin Krem was doing his scoffing when I debated him back in the 1982 for the first time. And I finally said, Mr. Krem, I can understand your opposition, your hostility. I said, after all, if I were on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, I wouldn't particularly want my friends dropping by the post office. But if they did come to the post office and they did read those wanted posters, I wouldn't want them taking anything literally.
Well, of course, Mr. Benjamin Krem is one of the leaders of course, this whole esoteric movement. In fact, I take his little pamphlet called The Emergence, and it just came about 2 weeks ago. And there, of course, they quote the world leader, the so-called Maitreya, as saying the best solution, of course, would be to destroy the economy of the West and out of the chaos that would result. They, of course, would come to into power.
That is very interesting in light of some new information that was fed to me a couple of weeks ago about Lester Brown and his World Watch Institute.
Well, I'd like to hear about that.
Okay. Well, I one of gal that has done some research in Texas and has been following up on these things, and she's worked with me off and on for about the last 20 years. She came out of the New Age movement herself, has had a few occasional relapses into it too, but God's still working with her, and she's loyal, and she's done some very good work. And she called me and pointed out to me some things that were on Lester Brown's site, and they called it Plan B. And actually you can download the book for free on the site. I actually managed to go in there and find it and download it. And I always do this before because when they know we're looking at them seriously, then they start burying it again. But I've got it all downloaded. And you could be an associate in Plan B by buying X number of copies of these books, and so then you would be on their honor roll and actually an associate. But Plan B to establish the New World Order actually called for the collapse of the world economy, starting with the United States.
And, of course, Lester Brown, of course, of the World Watch Institute, is one of the more influential people within, of course, this whole esoteric movement. Some of the wealthiest people in the world are part and parcel of that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Constance was just talking about the World Watch Institute, and of course, we've taken their publications for years, and of course, they tie right into the Council on Foreign Relations, and of course, all of these elitist groups, and they have members back and forth sharing ideas, and but of course, this whole thing, I think, is really leading very, very soon to this collapse of our economic system, and out of the chaos and of that, or perhaps the war that's coming, will come this desire for a new world order, a new world economic system, probably a new world currency. And heaven help us all, because most of the people in America will end up being totally impoverished. What are your thoughts on that?
Pardon?
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it looks like they've been doing one heck of a job. I mean, the euro is, even Canadian money now is worth more than our money. Our money used to be the most valuable in the world. Suddenly it's gone to being one of the most worthless in the world. And and look at what happened to Bear Stearns just a few weeks ago. And the Detroit economy, you go to the post office, I practice law. My offices are in Oakland County. and I'm in the Detroit metropolitan area. The whole area has been devastated by what has happened, but Oakland County is supposedly the second wealthiest county in the country. I think it was superseded only by Orange County in California, and Oakland County in Michigan was supposed to be the second wealthiest county in the country in terms of wealth. And you go to the courthouse, and the courthouse is literally papered with a huge wall of the courthouse foreclosure notices, and they're on reduced paper. They used to have them on full-size paper, but now there's so many, they're on shrunk-down paper, almost by a 3x5 card, and or maybe even smaller. And it just to the and huge and multiple sets, and the wall is just thick with them. It is.
Now, is this Detroit?
This is Oakland County.
In Oakland County.
Oakland County, the second wealthiest county in the country.
And of course, we expect this sort of thing in Detroit, but certainly not the second wealthiest.
Right. In fact, and it's almost tougher for those in Oakland County because there are people. Investors buying up the houses in Detroit and the other places because they can get them inexpensively and then invest in them and still turn a profit.
Hold that thought, we'll be back here in just a moment as we bring all of our stations on board to listen to Constance Cumby. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Constance Cumby, and she was just talking about the fact that she lives in Oakland County. It's a suburb of Detroit, but it's certainly one of the most wealthy, the second most wealthy county in the entire country, second only perhaps.
And we're not wealthy, but the county.
Right, of course, or maybe a Silicon Valley. But anyway, she was saying that when she goes to the courthouse, there's so many foreclosures, they can't put them on sheets of paper. They put them on 3x5 cards. And here in the second wealthiest county in the entire country, why, of course, there's so many foreclosures there, and they simply are multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. And people don't understand the seriousness of the economic problems we're facing. And, of course, everything the government is doing is simply destroying the value of our currency. Destroying the stability of our manufacturing. We continue shipping manufacturing overseas. There's very little money to lend out here in the United States, but I see where Intel is going to be investing another $500 million in communist China. So there's plenty of money to send to the communist Chinese, who will probably be our enemy and adversary in the next war, as we build up the military strength of our enemies and, of course, weaken ourselves. Well, before we go on, Constance, I want you to get your website or blog site out there and let people know how they could get your material and or how they could, listen to your blog spot, listen to the radio programs you do.
Okay, well, that's quite a bit. I have my own blog spot, and it's very active. I've learned that we checked it, we were checking statistics on it online and discovered it had been visited by 60 people from 69 countries and several thousand visitors in a month. And my blog spot is worldwideweb.cumby, .blogspot, .com. And then I'm a columnist with newswithviews.com. I manage to contribute about once a month an article over there, and they are archived on the internet. If you usually just Google a topic you're interested in, and they'll usually pop up in one of the top 10 in the world stories. I just recently did one on Hillary Clinton's New Age strategist. It was a sad thing to me because it looked like she had given some of these people quite a bit of influence in Bill's administration arranging Camp David conferences. And then some of these very people have turned on her. Marianne Williamson, for example, who organized a conference with her, said she wasn't going to vote with her vagina. She's going to vote for she's going to support somebody else for president. But I had written on that recently, and that had received a great deal of attention on the internet.
Okay,
additionally, I'm on the microeffect.com radio, internet radio, and that's Tuesday 2 p.m. Pacific time and Friday 2 p.m. Pacific time. And I do an hour, except today they asked me to stay on an extra hour. From time to time, they'll ask us to take an extra hour on the air, which is quite a bit. I'm talked out. Today, we took an extra hour on the air.
Okay. Well, because most people don't understand that Hillary is very, very deeply involved in the occult. And certainly, people have forgotten that when she first got to the White House back in, 1993,
mm-hmm.
why she brought a medium in to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi there in the White House.
Well, who she brought in was, actually, I wouldn't say a medium. The ones that she brought in, Marianne, she talked to Marianne Williamson. It was during a period of time when they were actually under a lot of stress. And she has an account of it in her book, Living History. And she, Bill and Hillary had a conference on these reinventing things. And a number of the New Age gurus were there. Bill had a number of them advising him, Stephen Covey, Anthony Robbins, Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson was at one of those Reinventing America conferences, or America Renaissance, some such thing. And so Hillary asked her if she would organize something at Camp David where these people could get together and advise she and Bill. And so they brought Marianne Williamson, Jean Houston, who's one of the worst of the New Agers, Catherine Bateson, who is the daughter of a new Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead. And then Hillary got into the Jean Houston walked her through it and took her on some guided visualization images to conjure up Eleanor Roosevelt. But what was frightening to me was how much power she turned over to the New Agers and how Jean Houston had virtually run of the White House for quite some time, and Marianne Williamson had pretty free access, and so did Catherine Bateson.
And I think for our listeners, Marianne Williamson wrote A Course in Miracles to push that, and of course it's being featured
by Oprah
Winfrey.
She didn't write it, but she certainly pushed it. And
right.
She's turned on Hillary Clinton now, too. And what's sad to me was that Hillary Clinton was raised in a Methodist home, and she says that she gets down on her knees and seeks God. And maybe she does. I have no reason to doubt her. She might be looking in all the wrong places if she's messing with these folks. And the United Methodist Church has not been exactly hostile to the New Age movement. Although there have been some segments of it that have recognized the evils and have even invited me to speak. I spoke to a conference of 1,000 United Methodist Church ministers once who were concerned about the New Age movement. They were the good guys in it, but there are a whole bunch of them that hold evolution Sundays and deify some of the New Age materials. And then Hillary Clinton participates in a Bible study in Washington, D.C., but the place that she participates in it, it looks good and Christian to some people, but this is the group that has an interlocking directorship with the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California, one of the prime New Age groups, and that sponsored a Unity Conference in 1987 and had Barbara Marx Hubbard chair the thing.
Well, don't you think, of course, Constance, when people say, you know, they are communing with God, maybe they're actually in touch with a different God. When people talk about Christ, they may be talking about not Jesus Christ, but the Christ, which is, of course, this universal world ruler.
The worst of it is that this particular group has Christian trappings, and many people believe it's a good, legitimate Christian organization. I did for a very long time until I discovered some very startling things. Starting in 1987, I knew there were problems with that group, but I didn't realize until just a year ago that the problems were so deep that there was the actual interlocking directorship with the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and that this had been no accident, and that when the secretary to this group that supposedly is giving Bible studies and a wholesome Christian atmosphere for people who were there sincerely thinking they were staying in touch with God, that they were instead working, in essence, undercover for a new world religion. One, like Barbara Marx Hubbard said, now all the groups with outwardly different purposes are merging and blending and coming together to do the one work. and there's been a real smugness on it. And it was interesting because the Fundamentalism Project, Fundamentalism's Observed, talked about this very thing and building it. And some bubblegum names, I'm not even going to name on the air because it would just be more than people could bear if they're inclined to look. They can go to page 4 of Fundamentalism's Observed at the University of Chicago. But it said, but as Orthodox people begin to organize for survival in a world dominated by the non-Orthodox, two significantly different strategies emerge. Seeking a broad cultural base for their gospel, one group saw benefits in learning to get along with outsiders. They did not wish to adopt the outsiders' ways, but they wanted to be respected. They began, especially after World War II, to take the name Evangelical for themselves, and I'm not going to name the one that they said was their primary representative because it's just too much shock for people on the air. So the other group insisted that getting along was no virtue, and that active opposition to liberalism, secularism, and communism was to be retained, pursued. This group retained the name Fundamentalist. This group, now we turn our attention. And so they were identifying that in these studies, the good guys were those that were willing to compromise. The bad guys were the ones that basically kept the faith. And they started studying us a long time ago. These books come from out of, I bought these books in the 80s and 90s. And they've been studying us as anthropologists for a long time, and now they think they're ready to put teeth into their mechanism via this vehicle called the Alliance of Civilizations. And they're getting ready to make some serious moves to regulate, for example, religious school curriculums worldwide. They're out stumping on it. They're giving prestigious platforms to speak on it. Karen Armstrong's been treated virtually as an icon, and she's dripping with hatred against Christians in her talk. People don't realize how much incitement there is out there, how serious it is, and how quickly they would like to move. Javier Solana said he was worried about the United States, that we were thinking in binary terms, black and white, good and evil, and he said, hey, in the European Union, we don't think that way. We think in terms of we're secular. We don't have things on abominations in our money like In God We Trust. We're secular here in the European Union. And so they're basically moving in on this. They've labeled evangelical Christianity in the United States as extremism that has to be eliminated and said, hey, the extremists are more dangerous than the terrorists because extremism can breed terrorism. And, hey, if we're going to talk about Muslim terrorists, then we have to talk about evangelicals in the United States because, look, hey, maybe they even bred Timothy McVeigh. And they are really getting ready to swoop down and to do it fast, and they're drumming these beats, and most Christians are not even aware that there is a war in process and that it's being stirred up by propaganda machines against us even as we're speaking.
And of course, if you were to read the original text of Barbara Marx Hubbard's book, Revelation, the book of co-creation.
That's an incredible book, and she's part of the machinery.
And of course, she talks in the original text, not in the one that you can buy, but we have the original pages, and I'm sure you do as well.
I've got that book.
Where she actually talks about the necessity. You know, there's a quarter of the population that will evolve to a higher level of consciousness,
yes.
Another half that will sort of go along with it, but there's a quarter that will not evolve.
A quarter of useless eaters and a quarter that absolutely have to be destroyed.
And she says, you know, they're going to have to be eliminated, but that's not your job, my dear. That is ours for
that
we.
That is ours. We come to bring death. We do this for the sake of the planet, the riders of the pale horse.
For we are
about
the
to pass among you, they will separate the wheat from the chaff. This is the most painful hour in Earth's history. And Shirley MacLaine is out there beating the drums on it also and gleefully saying it's Carmageddon. And Paul Hawken, who's been, he talked about the largest movement in the world, won the movement which nobody saw coming, and he said it was Mama, Pachamama. And I've learned now that that's part of the New Age vernacular for this basically the resurrection of some of the old Cape Dakotal type cults and the goddess worship top things. It's Mama. They're talking about enforced worship of Mother Earth, of the Earth itself, which is another line that Christians dare not cross, and enforced worship of that, intolerance, and they're also talking global tracking. They're moving in on us like a full-court basketball press.
And, of course, the average Christian has no idea what's going on because they're not being told by the media. They're certainly not being told by Rush Limbaugh. And they're not being told
by their pastors too often either.
You're absolutely right. And that's where the biggest problem is, because the pastors should be the ones. They're the ones that Christians look to for leadership. And most of them either don't know or they're afraid to speak out.
My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge.
Well, our job, of course, is to get the information out, and, of course, Constance does a wonderful job of that.
Well, so does Dr. Stan.
Well, of course, I don't have the knowledge that you do, but Constance's been at this since about 1980, wasn't it, when you just got started?
It was 1981. I'd been researching, but I hadn't stumbled onto this yet. It was 1981 when I knew what I was looking at.
And, of course, basically this is a Luciferian movement. It's so hard for Christians to believe that there really are people out there who knowingly, intentionally, and purposely would worship Lucifer.
Yeah.
How do you get people to understand that? It's so foreign to everything we think and believe that there really are people who worship a different God.
Well, I'm a lawyer, so I go Exhibit A, Exhibit B, or Exhibit 1, Exhibit 2, Exhibit 3. There's plenty of evidence on it. They really haven't tried to hide it. And what was so devastating in the Christian community when they were telling everybody to go back to sleep was they were telling them to ignore the evidence. That's why so many New Agers ran like they had seen the devil, and so many and came out of it. A lot of your really solid opposition to the New Age movement is from people who were in it that said, I was deceived, I was in this thing. It's out there, it's real, and I was in it, and if I was taken in, anybody could be taken in. And they're warning, in the meantime, many Christians just kind of smile smugly and think it doesn't exist, that after all, if it existed, they would have been told by popular television personalities, they would have been warned by their pastors, and the New Agers know it's there, the evidence is there, you don't have to convince them, you just have to convince them it's dangerous. It's too many Christians are just sound asleep. They don't believe it exists. And it's kind of like the Jesus parable about the 10 virgins. All 10 were sleeping. All 10 eventually woke up. 5 had enough oil in their lamps to go meet their maker. 5 didn't. And I think we'd better get very, very serious about what time it is and what our walk with God is.
Amen for that. In fact, I'm firmly convinced that the only thing that's going to see us through the difficult times that lie ahead is our faith. We can make all the preparations. I think people should make the preparations and do everything that's logical. But, of course, the most important preparation you can make is a personal relationship with our Lord.
That's the only out. They overcame the beast by the blood of the Lamb.
Amen.
And the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death.
Well, of course, we're really involved in most exciting, dangerous, and yet, of course, a prophetic battle that's taking place today. And, of course, Constance does a tremendous job. And how can people actually listen to your radio program there?
There are stations that it is on. I'll be hanged if I could tell anybody which ones they are. But there is, if people have a computer and speakers on their computer, we have international participation on the program, and it's worldwideweb.themicroeffect.com. T-H-E-M-I-C-R-O effect. The three words run on together. Themicroeffect.com. I think that if you go over there, they can also, if you want to participate and listen in the chat room, there's a chat room participation. You have to go over to something called Pal Talk for that or something like that, but you can set up the account for free and participate and listen at the same time. It's kind of fun, and we have a lot of good, really good active chat room participation while we're on the air, and people ask questions, and it's fun to do.
I know. Well, I enjoy talk radio a great deal as well. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our guest has been Constance Gumby, and, of course, we've been trying to make you aware of the fact we're moving into a terrible and frightening times. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Constance, you got 3 minutes to wrap up our program for the evening.
Well, in some serious times, and we've seen some acceleration of things since the beginning of the year, and definitely the New Agers are back on the march. I saw last week something I had not seen in a long time. a full-page, expensive-looking ad in one of the more expensive New Age magazines, one that's run by Andrew Cohen, I believe. And it was an ad by Benjamin Krem saying that the Christ's reappearance is very much an event in your immediate future. And, of course, that's not Christ, that's Antichrist. It's at least an Antichrist, and it may very well be the biblically prophesied Antichrist. Somebody is spending that kind of money, just as they ran 25 newspaper ads in 1982. They don't spend that kind of money without having a very serious purpose. The New Agers are busy beating the drums, talking about a coming shift and Carmageddon. And they're being psyched up into a mass following. Oprah Winfrey is having a huge worldwide church with her seminars, webinars, she calls them, on Eckhart Tolle and the New Earth. And this is going on, and people are being put in a frame of mind where it is okay to look down on those who insist on believing in Jesus Christ and insist on believing in God the Father and refuse to bow down to either the earth or to false gods on the earth. And we were warned that these times would come. We were told that those who endure until the end would be saved. And so we're going through these times. We have to, rather than panic, we have to trust God. It said, do not say unto those who say a conspiracy, or a confederacy, neither fear ye their fear, nor dread ye their dread. Sanctify the Lord of hosts yourself, and let himself, sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And he would be a bulwark, a shield to those who trusted in him, a sanctuary to those who trusted in him, and a stumbling block to those who would not. And let's have God on our side. The New Agers talk about digital divide. People in the other people are talking about a digital divide. You want to be on the right side of that digital divide. You want to be on the side of the digital divide where God is your sanctuary, not your stumbling block. Daniel said the wise would understand. None of the wicked would even understand what's happening. And basically, yes, to just pray for wisdom.
God bless. Good night.
Thank you so much. God bless you. Thanks.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just commented that we do talk during the breaks, and if you'd like to get the full text for tonight's program, why, of course, you would call 1-800-544-8927. It's available both on CD and on audio tape. And, of course, we have a four-tape set with Constance Cumby going into the background of the material that she's presented tonight and that she presents in her book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, which is out of print. And then we have a great DVD with Constance called The Emergence. And what is the emergence? The emergence is the coming of this great new spiritual world leader, which she talks about, and that were prophesied in the scriptures thousands of years ago. But these things are not imaginary. They're coming to pass as we speak. And we are living in the most exciting times in world history. Certainly, Oprah Winfrey is one of the high goddesses of this movement, and of course, she has endorsed on not one, but on two occasions the material put by a woman named Rhonda Burns. The Secret. There's a DVD, sold millions of copies. There's a book. I think it sold 7 million copies. And, of course, it is entirely based in the occult. The fact that there is a secret out there, you can harness for yourself the law of attraction, and, of course, it will give you power and wealth. It will give you whatever you want. And there are millions of Americans who are embracing this because, after all, Oprah Winfrey there on CBS wouldn't be giving us false information. Larry King wouldn't be giving us false information, or would they? Are they like the Pied Piper leading America to its destruction? Well, we have a four-CD set that addresses Rhonda Burns and her teachings. It's called The Secret Behind the Secret. The Secret Behind the Secret. Actually, I'd given a talk. It was called the forbidden secret. And when I gave that talk, and somebody at the end, when we got to the questions and answers, says, are you talking about Rhonda Burns and the secret? And I didn't even know what she was talking about at the time, but I do now. And, of course, we're all talking about the same secret. There is a secret that's been passed down for thousands of years through the secret societies, through the priests of the various mystery religions, and certainly great philosophers like Plato and like Aristotle and Pythagoras and Alexander the Great. They all knew these things, and of course you can read their writings and understand they know these things, but the average individual doesn't understand that the power is there, but you do not want to access it because, of course, it will cost you your eternal soul. So that is the secret behind the secret, the four-tape set or four-CD set. And then let me mention my talk available on DVD with the syllabus entitled The Forbidden Secret. And believe me, you're not supposed to really understand how this fits together. Oh, they'll give you a lot of gobbledygook. They'll give you a lot of phraseology, but they will never tell you what this is all about. It's about the worship of a different God. It's about your eternal soul. It's about the prince of this world. Well, certainly if you've not yet seen the DVD or videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll. There's a 3-hour, a 4-hour, or a 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. It is probably one of the most effective tools that we have to explain what's really going on. It's put together by Pastor Joe Schimmel, who himself became a channeler for the demonic spirit that controlled him. And then, of course, when he realized what was happening, it transformed his life. And certainly you can hear some of my interviews with Joe Schimmel, and they are available from Radio Liberty. But, of course, remember, all of these items are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our website. You can listen to our programs there, actually 4 hours a day live. You can, of course, listen to our archive programs. You can listen to our MP3 programs. You can certainly listen to our satellite feed 9 hours a day. We're involved in a spiritual struggle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back in just a moment. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but in the battle of survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff sponsors, the supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly a senior editor of the New American Magazine and now a frequent guest on Radio Liberty. And, of course, he's written a book, The Eclipse of Liberty, which we do carry. That's The Eclipse of Liberty. And then, of course, he writes for a blog spot and works with the Wells Foundation. And title is Liberty in Eclipse. But right now, let's go to William Grigg. Hi, William. How are you doing tonight?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
All right, fine. Sounds like your cough's getting a little bit better.
Yeah, I'm doing just fine.
All right, just
we're all healthy for the first time in living memory, all seven of us.
All right, fine. And for William has five children. And he's been having to raise them pretty much on his own. But anyway, his wife has been ill, but fortunately his wife is back home, so things are looking up a little bit. Well, what are we going to talk about tonight?
I think it's worthwhile when, on those occasions when in the secular press or the mainstream media, however you want to style it, you see these disclosures of the fact that there is a ruling oligarchy, it's worthwhile to talk a little bit about those disclosures. They come every once in a while. The most dramatic, of course, in recent memory was the publication of Tragedy and Hope some 43 years ago, Carol Quigley magnum opus, which talked about the Council on Foreign Relations, the Anglo-American network that is part of the roundtable groups, and how there is this semi-submerged network of power that you might call the power elite. And there was a book in the 1950s called The Power Elite that talked about the same concept. There's a fellow who writes for Newsweek magazine by the name of David Rothkopp, who has published a book called Superclass, which talks about that same group of people, at least to a certain extent. He's talking about the same group of people. The cohort he's referring to does include the power elite or the members of this Anglo-American network that Carol Quigley described that have been referred to as the power elite. I haven't read the book yet, but Mr. Rothkopp has been interviewed in Salon, which is an online journal, a daily journal, and he also had a piece that just came out this last week entitled What Power Looks Like, which talks about his analysis of the superclass. There's some really interesting little disclosures here. He talks about a conversation he had with Lloyd Blankfein, who's the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he refers to the financial element of the superclass as being a group of people like the 14 families from The Godfather. And when we saw recently how the Federal Reserve worked with such assiduity to bail out Bear Stearns, and how with great haste and great efficiency, they put together this multi-billion dollar bailout package, buying up the junk stock of what had been the fifth largest investment bank in the country in the course of a weekend, putting the taxpayers on the hook to bail out Bear Stearns. That's the sort of thing that the superclass excels at. These are people who may or may not be in offices of political nature. They may or may not be elected officials or appointed officials. What Mr. Rothkopp says when he talks about this superclass is that they have vastly more power than any other group on the planet. Each of the members is set apart by his ability to regularly influence the lives of millions of people in multiple countries worldwide. That's the type of people you and I have been talking about, Dr. Stan, and it's worthwhile when every once in a while you see a disclosure of this sort to talk about it, to point out we're not making these things up.
In fact, I remember Friedrich Lundberg's book, The America's 40 Families, or
yeah,
certainly my last 82 years in America, Ambassador Girard. He was part and parcel of this, and he commented there were probably about 50 families that ruled the United States, and they all worked together. And of course, that book came out, we'll be back in just a moment here.
Yeah, it's not so much as saying that we're dealing with your classic feudal oligarchy, although I think what we're talking about does have elements of sort of a feudalistic system about it. We're talking about something that's a little bit more variegated, a little more sophisticated than that. Go back to David Rothkopp from Newsweek, his analysis of this superclass, as he calls it. They have vastly more power than any other group on the planet. He's just talking about a few hundred people, by the way. He's narrowed it down to just a handful of people out of the billions who inhabit the world right now. Each of the couple of hundred, 300 or 400 people he's talking about has the ability regularly to influence the lives of millions of people in multiple countries worldwide. Each actively exercises this power and often amplifies it through the development of relationships with other superclass members. this new class of elites is both more permeable and more transient than elites of the past. The age of inherent lifelong power is largely behind us, he says. To be a member of this superclass, one has to hold on to power just long enough to make an impact. And then he goes into some financial and economic analysis of the superclass. He points out that the top 10% of all people, for example, now control 85% of all wealth on the planet. Now, when he talks about wealth, I think a parenthetical elaboration is appropriate here. When he talks about wealth, he's not just talking about the sort of thing that you'd have in a bank account, because that does tend to be somewhat ephemeral. We've seen, a $1 trillion or so in purported wealth, in virtual or theoretical wealth that's evaporated now with the shakeout and the unwinding of a lot of these supposed assets of banks like Bear Stearns. But we're talking about people who actually have the type of capital assets and who are positioned at the top of institutions in such a way that they are part of this political and economic elite. These are people who have the ability, by virtue of the political connections they have made, to control this amount of wealth. And when we talk about the 15-85 split here, 15% of the people controlling 85% of the wealth, we're not saying that we should have a Marxist revolution so as to redistribute the wealth. What we're talking about is that these people have used the power of government, the power of the state, and the power of transnational entities that work like a global governing system to accumulate this wealth and to exercise control over it. Socialism has always been and always will be about controlling rather than redistributing the wealth, and it always ends up with that type of disproportion in terms of the allocation of wealth in the society.
And I think one of the hardest things for the average individual to understand or to believe is that it is people of great wealth who encourage socialism, who
yes.
promote socialism, who want socialism. And everybody says, well, isn't socialism going to redistribute their wealth? And no, it's not. It's only your wealth and mine that's going to be redistributed. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney William was talking about a recent article and a recent book written by a gentleman who actually works for Newsweek magazine on the superclass, these people of great wealth, who are certainly are influencing what's going on in the world today, perhaps 100 to 150 of them at the most. But what's even more significant is that, as he points out, these people work through socialism and through communism to increase their wealth and power. And people think that this is a contradiction. I mean, why would people of great wealth push socialism? Well, very simply, because, of course, here in the United States, it breaks down all the restrictions on power. It centralizes all power in Washington, D.C., which is what our founding fathers feared and certainly warned us against. And then, of course, when all power is in Washington, D.C., who's going to hold the power? Our elected representatives? No, we would have the finest politicians that money could buy. These people of great wealth would buy and sell the politicians, and they use the power of government to increase their wealth and to destroy the competition. We see this today with the oil companies using the environmental movement and the government to destroy their opposition. So we have just a very few large oil companies. And, of course, last quarter of last year, Exxon made more money than any other corporation in the history of all mankind. Why? Because government has prevented them having any competition. You pick up the story there, William.
When you talk specifically about the oil sector, the energy sector, the one thing that we have to have in order to enjoy the standard of living and the amenities of the industrial society and the information society to which we've become accustomed, that is the most government-controlled sector of the economy on the planet. The Economist magazine, about a year and a half ago, if I remember correctly, put out a really interesting story. The Economist magazine, by the way, is a Keynesian socialist publication, so it's not as if you're dealing with people who are right-wing in their outlook and whose perceptions are distorted by their commitment to an outmoded ideology. The Economist is a leftist publication. And they put out a chart and a story about a year and a half ago, I believe in the summer of 2000, in which they documented the extent to which the oil companies of the world are owned and operated by state governments. They're almost all completely nationalized or effectively nationalized through intermediate corporate entities that are controlled by the various governments. And the big difference with the American oil companies, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, is that they're not so much nationalized as they work in tandem with the government to cartelize the economy through the use of the environmental movement and subsidiary movements that raise the entry price of their competitors in a prohibitive way. It's very easy for a large industrial concern, an established politically secure corporation, to deal with the type of costs that are involved in complying with this regulatory burden that a startup would find completely insurmountable. And that's one of the reasons why you have these huge financial donations being made to the environmental movement by way of foundations controlled by the energy industry here in the United States. So that shows how there's this very, collegial is the wrong word, symbiotic relationship, I think is a better way of describing it, between the American oil concerns and the federal government. And it's very carefully disguised, it's very artfully hidden, but it's something which is quite documentable. All you have to do is go get the Foundation Grants Index. They're published every year. Go to your local library. I think it might be available online. It's been a while since I've looked for it online. I do know that elements of it are available on the net. But the yearly Foundation Grants Index will give you an idea of the extent to which these environmental groups and other pressure organizations are funded by foundations which are basically run by the energy industry, the oil companies in this country. And we talk about the analysis that Rothkopf gives us of this so-called superclass, where you have the 15% controlling 85% of the wealth. Once again, it's important to recognize that these people control the wealth through their collaboration with governments. It's been said, I believe it was by Joseph Sobrin, that the Constitution of the United States poses no threat to our system of government. And in roughly the same sense, you can say that the people who are in charge of our corporate economy right now, the last thing they want is to see a free market break out. These people are not free market capitalists. They're what Adam Smith called men of system. They prosper through their political connections and their ability to liaise with those who exercise government power, as opposed to finding and satisfying market niches in true free market capitalist style. In breaking down this superclass, this power elite a little bit further, Mr. Rothkopf writes that it includes the heads of the biggest financial institutions, the 14 families that Blankfein of Goldman Sachs joked about, and then some. The top 50 control almost $50 trillion in assets. The heads of the world's biggest corporations are also members. The top 2,000 support perhaps 500 million people, generate almost $30 trillion in sales, and have well over $100 trillion in assets. Once again, I need to interrupt by pointing out that a lot of that is tied up in dubious financial vehicles and derivatives, and we're going to be paying to keep these people in the positions that they enjoy right now. That's the way the system works. It's socialism for the super rich. Put the taxpayer on the hook to indemnify the losses and to subsidize the risks while keeping the profits private. There's nothing private enterprise about this. To continue, the list of the superclass also includes top government officials with real cross-border influence. Heads of state, of course, leading diplomats and military chiefs, but also central bankers like Gunther and Bernanke, and their counterparts like Chinese central bank governor Zhou Xuanchuan, reappointed this week, and the other top economic officials responsible for the world's fastest-growing economy and its nearly $1.5 trillion in reserves. Pretty good thumbnail sketch here of this group. However you want to characterize it, you want to call them the insiders, which is a very familiar way of describing that group, the power elite, the superclass, the uber class, the aristocracy, the oligarchy, however you want to characterize it. It does exist, and it's very important that people recognize that these are powerful people who have an immediate and tangible influence on their lives. They're certainly feeling that influence every time you go to the gas pump, every time you go through the checkout line. The way that the economy is structured is guaranteed to be siphoning wealth out of what you earn and what you make, and putting it into a system that benefits these people, because they're all tied up with the Federal Reserve. I mean, the Federal Reserve is pretty much their instrument, the entity that emits the currency that we use and thereby devalues the earnings that we make and assets that we have saved. Every time you go to the gas pump and you're paying inflated prices for something you can't live without, every time you go to the checkout counter and find that the price of your staple foods has gone up because of price inflation, that's a reflection of the process that has enriched these people. These people are battening on and profiting off the process of inflation that is destroying the American middle class, which is why we're seeing the emergence of this oligarchy, and the rest of us are getting pushed down to the bottom rungs of the ladder. And it's because of the political system, the politicization of the economy that we're dealing with. And to continue now, some of the comments that Rothkopf makes, a glance at this high-powered class illuminates several key trends. Political elites may be the primary powers where national governments remain dominant in places like China, Russia, and much of the Middle East. Yet overall, the list reveals a marked shift from public to private power. Globalization and, to a large extent, privatization has fueled the superclass and vice versa. Once again, I have to interject. When he talks about privatization, he's not talking about true privatization. He's talking about subcontracting functions of government to government-supported entities that are largely unaccountable, but that profit off of the political system and the machinations of government. These are not truly private entities. To continue, in the 1960s, the average international company had 100 subsidiaries. Today, many number their subsidiaries in the tens of thousands. In the 1950s, the big post-war U.S. defense establishment had a budget that was larger than the revenues of all major U.S. companies put together. Today, even though the defense budget is larger in real dollar terms, the sales of two major U.S.-based global corporations, Exxon and Walmart, outstrip it by more than 50%. This concentration of wealth and economic influence has translated into a concentration of power, a trend helped by the fact that the power of national governments is on the wane in many parts of the world. The rise of transnational activities, both public and private, a broad move away from state intervention in national markets, and the effective reduction in the state's ability to use force due to the awesomely high price of modern warfare have all contributed to the declining power of the individual nation-state. In turn, those whose organizations are built for global activity, like multinational companies or financial institutions, or terrorist networks or NGOs, that is, non-governmental organizations, have gained a relative advantage over individual governments and governmental organizations. Now, that's a very interesting point because he's talking about what the United Nations calls the global civil society, and that's composed of these non-governmental organizations that are approved and licensed by the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations to be involved in UN activities and work with UN subsidiaries and affiliates in various ways. He mentions the Gates Foundation, which is very definitely involved in a lot of UN activities, particularly in the population realm. But these are force multipliers for the political elite. He misunderstands the nature of that relationship. He's very good, I think, at limiting this large oligarchy and then giving a sort of a flow chart or a schematic of how it operates. But I think he's missing some of the large conceptual points.
William, actually, I've interviewed Mr. Rothkopf.
Have you
I've
really?
Read his book, Running the World, in which he admits that he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, there you go.
And pooh-poohs the idea that it's part of any sort of a conspiratorial organization, or that the Trilateral Commission is certainly a major force, or that the neocons are running the Bush administration. So, I mean, somebody who is part and parcel of this, I don't think could be that naive. Certainly, what he's saying is there is a superclass. This is true, but I suspect that he is allowed to write books and give the information out because he conceals the real forces behind the scenes, and then certainly the occult forces behind the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, Club of Rome, Masons, all the other organizations, which work together to rule the world.
Yeah. You're dealing here with somebody who's sort of a journalistic bikini. They said about a bikini is that what it conceals is more interesting than what it reveals. It reveals just enough to be enticing.
I mean, his book, Running the World, was fascinating. I'm certainly going to want to get his book on the super class, but obviously he is going to do everything to divert our attention away from the people who are really running things in the world and poo-poo the idea that the Rockefeller family is coordinating the activities in the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers and the Council on Foreign Relations. That's the last thing they would want the public to know. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, go right ahead.
It's interesting you brought up the issue of the Rockefellers because I was just going to make the point that in his treatment of the way that the superclass works, he made a point of showing how the Rockefellers, in terms of the assets that they commanded, were supposedly vastly outstripped by this new superclass. And I was going to make the point here that either through ignorance or deliberate design, that is to say deliberate deception, he had really gotten the wrong analytical tool here and applied it to this situation because what makes the Rockefellers so interesting and what makes the Rockefellers so central to what you and I discuss in terms of the power elite is this decades-long effort to build this very detailed and formidable network, this, you have to call it conspiratorial apparatus, that melds these financial players to the government. And of course, behind this, you do have this concerted effort to follow a spiritual or a religious design, you know, the spiritual paradigm that Stephen Rockefeller and Gorbachev and Maurice Strong put down in writing as the Earth Charter. That's of course the soul in the machine here, and that the Rockefellers for literally decades have been working that element of things, and what makes them so provocative is the fact that they had feet in both the political and economic camp and in the spiritual camp as well, in terms of their efforts to adulterate and transfigure Christianity into a form more compatible with these global designs. And, you know, Rothkopf's analysis and his disclosures that I find so arresting here are intended, I believe, to a certain extent to be a smokescreen. But I think there's another motivation at work here as well, and that is that at some point the people who are involved in this want to take credit for how clever they are. There was the scene at the end of that movie Wag the Dog that came out about 10 years ago about a president gets in trouble because of his undisciplined libido, and so to distract the public, they stage a phony war on Albania. And at the end of that show, at the end of that movie, the Hollywood producer who put together this whole program was told, you can't tell anybody about this.
That was Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, Dustin Hoffman's character was told by Robert De Niro's character. By the way, the fact that they were on the screen at the same time shot down to my theory that they were really the same guy. But the two of them were talking at the end of the film, and he was told by Mr. Motz, the character played by Robert De Niro, you can't tell anybody. You can have an ambassadorship, you can have a high-ranking cabinet position, but nobody can know what we've done. This has to remain a secret. And he was, that is to say, the De Niro character was trying everything he could to ply this Hollywood producer with favors and promises and trying to buy his silence. And finally, Hoffman said, no, I want the credit. I want the credit for this. Somebody just has to know. And next thing you know, the guy's dead. Well, at some point, I think there is this perverse desire people have for some kind of credit. They have to be acknowledged for being so clever and so artful in deceiving the entire world, and by goading us into following their instructions, manipulating us, dulling us into slavery, that they have to let slip something. And for instance, when Armin Hammer had his officially commissioned biography come out about 30 or 40 years ago, I can't remember exactly how long it was, his official biography made him look like a pretty awful guy. And I think that's because he wanted, at some level, to be validated as somebody who was a master manipulator, somebody who was a very capable and...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Tim was just saying that he thinks that certainly the people who run the world really want some of this information out. They want people eventually down the line to realize how clever they are. Here's a small cadre, a few hundred people that control the wealth of the world, have simply destroyed the infrastructure of America, moving us towards world government, plunges us into war after war, centralized ever more power and wealth in their hands. But he says, just pointing out several examples, that their real goal is down the line, they want people to realize how smart they are. Pick the story up.
Yeah. Yeah, at the end of this this movie, Wag the Dog, the producer arranged this entire pageant, as he called it, decided that he simply could not resist the temptation to seek acclaim or to seek credit, and as a result, he ended up getting killed. And in the real life, you have somebody like Armin Hammer, who was really the power elitist nom pare. He was somebody who came from a dynastic family of traitors and communist functionaries, somebody who was the Soviet path to the West and profited very handsomely on the fact that he had no morals but a great deal of power. When his officially approved biography, when his authorized biography came out, I believe in the 1970s, a lot of the disclosures in that book made him look really pretty bad, but they did reveal that he was somebody who was accustomed to working in the stratospherically high realms of influence. And I think that he was willing to take a couple of blows to his reputation in order to be seen as a certifiable heavyweight in this global power elite. And the same sort of thing happened, I think, in the PBS special from the mid-1980s that was a profile of David Rockefeller done by Bill Moyers. Bill Moyers, of course, is a CFR member. He's somebody who knows who Rockefeller is and knows the really paramount role that he has played in creating the Trilateral Commission and being the former head of the CFR, and knows the Rockefeller family played a signal role in bringing about the creation of all these instruments of power that are destroying our country. Bill Moyers was his dutiful Boswell, if you will, his dutiful scribe, and depicting just a common several days in the life of the man Moyers described as the chairman of the Eastern establishment and the most powerful man in the world. And he said that, and I'm trying to paraphrase as closely as possible, by way of summarizing the importance of David Rockefeller, Moyers said that what most people would call a global conspiracy, he calls a day at the office. And I think that that was done for a reason. These people have to have a scrapbook of some sort, if you will. I mean, obviously they have wealth that most of us simply can't imagine. Every material urge or appetite they have is instantly, or at least very quickly, sated. I don't doubt for a second that at least a few of them know that their eternity is going to be very unpleasant. Armin Hammer certainly knew that. He tried to hedge his bets with a deathbed conversion of very dubious sincerity, as did Voltaire a couple of hundred years ago, Voltaire being a pretty similar personality. I think that at some point they want the rest of us to know that we're just not as smart as they are. We're not as clever, not as astute. We're not as adept. We don't really run our lives. They want the satisfaction of really doing a little bit of a celebratory dance in front of us and boosting their egos that way. Because, you know, Dr. Stan, at the bottom of all this is that satanic promise from the book of Genesis that you will be as gods. And to be a god, small g, a supposed god, is to be worshipped. And I think that the basic psychology here is that these people want to be worshipped. They don't simply want us to submit. They don't simply want us to underwrite their fortunes, although they're very happy that we're doing that involuntarily. And they're very happy, of course, when we submit like docile sheep or cattle to their rule. But they want us to worship them. At some level, they want us to put them on a pedestal and to bow down before us. I mean, that's the old Babylonian paradigm or the old Egyptian pagan paradigm of the ruler is God on earth, as somebody who is simply made of finer and more numinous material than the rest of us.
Well, you know, that's really very interesting. I had the opportunity of interviewing William H. Sullivan, who was the former ambassador to both Laos and Iran. And he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and we talked for about an hour or so. And then he mentioned David Rockefeller, and it was with just total adoration, just almost worshipful of this man, this unique man, this unique human being. He was so proud that he knew David Rockefeller, and David Rockefeller knew him. And your remarks, of course, I think are so apropos. And I've often wondered, what hold did David Rockefeller have on this man? I liked him. He's a very likable fellow. I mean, certainly the top of our State Department. And David Rockefeller certainly must have a capacity, almost a charismatic capacity, to control other people.
Yeah, there's got to be that element of spiritual influence. That's what charisma is. Charisma is a type of blessing that rivets the attention of people to the person who exudes charisma. And it takes various forms. And it is a spiritual battle that we're fighting. There's no doubt about that.
All right, hang on. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg as we discuss this idea of the super class. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, William Grigg. William, pick the story up from there.
Well, Dr. Stan, did you happen to see the piece in the Guardian of London today about this new retreat that is planned for the Nevada desert for the power elite?
No, I didn't. Tell me about it.
Okay. It's entitled Away From It All, A Retreat for World Leaders. It's a $300 million plan to build a really bizarrely constructed retreat that's a sphere surrounded by what looks to be a twisting, convoluted crown of thorns The way it's described here is that it looks like an earthbound Death Star from Star Wars, and the title of this retreat would be the Universitas Leadership Sanctuary. It would be about 17 miles away from Las Vegas. And the story from The Guardian begins as follows. Forget checkers and the Palace of Versailles. The next time Gordon Brown or Nicolas Sarkozy need a bolt hole in which to recharge their batteries or a place for a private powwow, they might find themselves lured to a new retreat amid the pink rocks of the Nevada desert. Donna Vassar, part of the Vassar Education Dynasty, has launched plans to build a $300 million private getaway for stressed-out presidents and prime ministers who want to reconnect with their unique purpose in life. The Universitas Leadership Sanctuary is intended as part monastery and part conference center, where the most powerful men and women on the planet can get away from it all with a combination of reading, contemplation, and even a spot of gardening. By the way, I don't think that those would be the only options available for the delectation of those who would have access to that facility. To continue now with the story, to remind them of their role as leaders of the planet, the sanctuary will be built in the shape of a four-story globe on the shores of Lake Las Vegas, a privately owned lake in the South Nevada desert where temperatures can reach 50 degrees centigrade, that is, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, at the height of summer. Vassar, whose family established the liberal arts college of the same name in New York State, has unveiled plans which include libraries, contemplation spaces, and debating chambers. She intends to recreate a monastic existence which means entourages of press officers, policy advisors, and secretaries which routinely support world leaders will be banned. There will even be a garden to provide food for the sanctuary tables, raising the prospect of future world leaders tilling the soil together while ruminating on the direction of the latest round of world trade talks. Quote, the Universitas Leadership Sanctuary will be a center specifically created to embrace and challenge the leaders, says the vision document, which Vassar has published. Together we will create an individual journey leading to the highest place within, enabling leaders to reconnect with their unique purpose in life.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about something fascinating. We'll get to that in just a moment. But before we go on, I do want William to tell our listeners how they can get to his blog and, of course, where they can get his material. So would you like to tell people about that?
Sure. I appreciate that, too. The easiest way to get to my blog is to go to the webpage maintained by the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. And the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, rightsourceonline.com. The Right Source webpage is a news page. It's a portal to various news stories, video clips, audio files that we find of interest regarding political developments of consequence. And it's something that is assembled with an eye single to the glory of God and also an interest in the preservation of human liberty under God's law. That's the perspective we bring to analyzing the news. That's the perspective that's reflected in the opinion pieces that we publish on The Right Source as well. If you go to that website at the very top of the page, there is an advertisement for my most recent book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, the War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can buy it directly through The Right Source website. You can order it for Radio Liberty as well. And as of today, it's also available on Amazon.com.
Great.
Yeah, I think that's very worthwhile. I just found that out. As a matter of fact, while we were doing a previous segment, I got an instant message from a friend of mine saying that the book's now available on Amazon. If you go down the left-hand side of the first page of the Right Source website, you'll find my photograph, and next to it is a hyperlink which will take you to my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. I try to publish between 3 and 5 times a week, and Pro Libertate is different from a lot of blogs in that I usually write pieces that are somewhere between 1,200 and 2,000 words, and they're intended to be exercises in investigative polemicism, if you will. I'm definitely writing opinion pieces. Make no mistake about that. They're thoroughly biased. They reflect my somewhat peculiar slant on the world, and they're all focused on the issue of freedom. Once again, Pro Libertate means for freedom in Latin, and I try to update that as frequently as I can. And the other thing I wanted to point out for your listeners is that just this week I was invited to address the conference, the actually the convention of the United Republicans of California. I believe that you might be there as well, Dr. Sten. I know you were there last year, but on April 26th of this year at the Embassy Suites in Arcadia, California, I'm going to be in attendance, and I believe I'm the first to speak that Saturday morning at the convention of the United Republicans of California. That's April 26th, just a couple of weeks from tomorrow at the Embassy Suites in Arcadia, California. And we will have a supply of books on hand at the literature table. Copies of Liberty and Clips will be available there. And I hope that you'll be there, Dr. Sten, and I hope that a lot of our listeners will be there as well. I'd like to meet as many people as possible. They're all wonderful folks.
Yeah, it's a very, very good meeting. Well, before we went to the break, we were certainly talking about the fact that in the South Nevada desert, some 10, 15 miles from Las Vegas, they're establishing a center for the leaders of the world where they can get together and till the soil. Now, these are multi-billionaires. Some of them, you know, may even have more money than that. But, of course, this will be for a very exclusive group of people where they can get together and talk and plan and get back to nature. But, you know, really what's so interesting, how far is this from Henderson, Nevada? Do you have any idea?
Well, it's 17 miles from Las Vegas, I would assume, because this is, if I remember my geography correctly, I think this is to the south and west of Las Vegas, so it would be closer to Henderson. It'd probably only be 5 or 10 miles away from Henderson.
The reason that this is so interesting is the fact that there is a book written by, I believe, Wayne Peterson, who, of course, was deeply involved with the occult, who had actually met, who had been recruited into this movement by David Rockefeller, who is had been in charge of the Fulbright scholarships for the State Department. But, of course, he was deeply involved in the occult. And he has said that the people, occultists from all over the world, are going to Henderson, Nevada. They're waiting for the return of the Christ. And
yeah,
sort of like that movie we had, The Strange Encounters of the Third Time, where people were of the third kind, people were all drawn to this one spot. Well, they're being drawn to Henderson, Nevada. It's interesting that this other center you're describing is so close to that, where the leaders of the world are going to be.
Yeah, that is an interesting and provocative, I wouldn't say coincidence, I'd say convergence of facts, that you'd have this bizarre monastic community, or this proposal, rather, to build this bizarre monastic-style retreat for the world super elite within a very near distance of Henderson. I'll look into that a little bit more deeply, because I am so provoked by that.
Well, let me point out, there's a book entitled, and I think it's Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary People by Wayne Peterson, and we do carry the book only for research purposes. We make it available. We do not put it on our regular list. We don't want people to think that we're endorsing it, but it's Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary People by Wayne Peterson. And, of course, there he talks about they're converging from all over the world on Henderson, Nevada. Of course, you're not going to hear this from Rush Limbaugh, but what a coincidence, isn't it?
How long ago was that book published?
Oh, probably about, I think, about 2003, somewhere
okay.
there.
Yeah, that is really quite interesting. Henderson, of course, is a town that was built by the military-industrial complex as well. I mean, Las Vegas was built by the mob, and Henderson was built by the mob that controls the mob, if you will. It's really quite a lovely city. I don't know how often you've been to Henderson, but it's beautiful. It's very expensive to live in. I've got family and friends who live there. But for a number of reasons, I wouldn't want to live there, and some of the reasons you've accosted here with your comments about the occultic dynamic, the undertow that's pulling people there. And I do think it's interesting here in this proposal to build this retreat, this Universitas Leadership Sanctuary there in the Nevada desert, so close to Las Vegas and Henderson, that the article in The Guardian from London today points out that this is something that represents an effort of the sort that's happened elsewhere in the world. The author points out that this is not the first attempt to bring world leaders together in a different environment to the conference halls and meeting rooms of the United Nations, Davos, and Camp David. In late 2006, President Nazarbayev of Kazakhstan opened the Pyramid of Peace in Astana, his capital. The 77-meter-high building, designed by Lord Foster, includes a 1,500-seat opera house. At its apex, it is crowned by a meeting space decorated with the images of doves, especially designed to host conferences of the leaders of the world's religions. Vassar has set up a Destination Universitas Foundation, a New York charitable foundation, to raise money for the project, which he estimates will take 2.5 years to build. That's not very long at all, by the way. 2.5 years is just a tick on the clock. She is traveling the world to meet potential donors and has told them her mission is, quote, to create better balance in the world by transforming leaders. Spokesman for the Lake Las Vegas Resort confirmed that late last year the foundation expressed an interest in buying a 65-acre plot in its development, and so on and so forth, and it mentions that it's about 17 miles away from the Las Vegas Strip. So, yeah, it's probably pretty close to Henderson. One of the retreats they didn't mention, but they very well could have mentioned, was Maurice Strong's Babylonian-style ziggurat at what he calls, I believe it's the Terra Retreat there in Colorado, Mountains of Colorado. These people are always finding redoubts and hideaways of this sort where they can commune with each other and then marinate in mutual approbation of each other's as elevated above the common run of humanity. But I do think it's interesting that, once again, there is this resonance that you described, Dr. Stan, with the idea of people gathering in Henderson to await the coming of the quote-unquote Christ. And by that, I assume you're referring to Lord Maitreya. Is that
right,
the individual they're talking
right,
about?
Right, and he claims that he's actually met him. This Wayne Peterson says he's actually met him, and he's met him several times, and he's told him this is the place they're come to wait for his return.
Well, that is really interesting. If they've only got 2.5 years of construction on this project, then some interesting things will probably be happening sometime around 2011, if our suspicions are correct here. But this once again points out that we're dealing with something that's not merely measured in terms of policy pronouncements and political enactments and laws and regulations and ordinances and so forth, and it's not merely measured by the money supply or the interest rates or the other things that we would apply to understand what's going on in the economy. There is definitely a strong spiritual subtext to this that propels the perverse idealism of these people who belong to the superclass or the power elite. And I think, once again, at the bottom of it, they see themselves as sort of an elect. They're people are called out from the rest of humanity, and they want, after a fashion, to have us worship them. That's been more or less at the root of every movement towards unifying humanity from Nimrod until today, is the idea that we can make a name for ourselves. Nothing will be withheld from us if we unite under one group and we have all of humanity subject to our power. And I think that that's a deathless element of the depravity of fallen man, is this desire for power over others. Just in the last week or so, I've been reading for the first time the unabridged version of City of God by St. Augustine. I read the abridged version a number of decades ago when I was in college, and I decided I might as well read the whole thing. It's about the size of the dictionary, but it's surprisingly easy reading. But one of the comments that he comes back to, one of the themes that he keeps coming back to, is this lust for power, this libido dominandi, the appetite, the almost sexual appetite that people have to dominate other people, and how there are certain people in whom this is simply a deathless impulse. I mean, people like you and me, Dr. Stan, I have no interest in dominating other people.
No, nor do I.
I remember about 22 or 23 years ago, there was a song that was very popular by a rock band called Tears for Fears. The song was entitled Everybody Wants to Rule the World. And when I came out, I was struck by a couple of things. First of all, it was a very nice song, and the lyric was quite intelligently written, but I found myself thinking, that's not quite true. I've got no desire to rule the world. I just want to be left alone by the people who want to run the world. And a free world really would run itself if people would obey the two great commandments, you know, love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself, conduct their affairs according to those two great commandments, be honest in their dealings with each other. The world would run itself. But unfortunately, there are others who just seem to think that they were ordained by God or history or something or somebody to run the lives of the rest of us for our supposed benefit. And they're the type of people who are always flocking to these retreats at the UN, at Davos, Camp David, at this Death Star-like retreat in the desert of southern Nevada, assuming it gets finished. They're the folks who really are running the world in which we live and planning our future for us. And it really should offend us a whole lot more than it does.
Well, this is because most people really can't believe this. Most people really certainly are enjoying the wonderful utopian existence we have here. And when somebody comes along like you or like me and tells them that this is all make-believe, we're going to lose this, and if you're not involved, why, of course, freedom is going to become simply a matter of things past, a remembrance of things past. Mm-hmm. They don't want to hear this. Nobody wants to hear bad news any more than the patient wants to hear they have cancer. But we do have a cancer. It's eating away at the very fabric of our society, and your job and my job is to sound the alarm.
Well, cancer is a really good way of describing it because, of course, a cancer metastasizes, and at a certain point it gets into elements of the body that simply are unreachable. And we may have reached that point with respect to the economic dimension of the illness that we've been fighting. You take a look at what's going on today. I think three of their major funds were the Lehman Brothers got dissolved or liquidated today. I think they got rid of three of them. And Lehman Brothers, of course, was the investment bank that a lot of us thought was going to follow Bear Stearns down the drain a few weeks ago.
And may very well still follow it.
Very well. I just simply don't see how they can manage to avoid it.
I mean, when you're looking at some banks like Union Bank of Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
it's lost $38 billion. I mean, you know, a billion here, a billion there, but you talk about $38 billion that they've had to write down, you know, since the first quarter of last year. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I should say since the last quarter of last year. And certainly Morgan Stanley, Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase has something like $90 trillion in derivatives they're responsible for now they've taken on Bear Stearns. I mean, there's no way if those things start to unravel that they can survive. The Federal Reserve, all of the central banks of the world don't have enough money to counter what really lies ahead.
Yeah, and the thing that I find interesting as well, as we're taking a look at the health of the economy or the lack of the health of the economy right now, already, and this is a subject we talked about last week, but we can't, I think, overstate the importance of this, already we're seeing this horrible specter in distant countries of food riots, and the reason people are rioting is not because food is scarce, they're rioting because food is so expensive. The reason why food is so expensive is because the United States has been exporting its inflation, its monetary inflation worldwide, the dollar being the reserve currency of the world through the petrodollar arrangement with the Saudi Arabians and OPEC. And because we've been exporting a dollar inflation, you have price inflation now hitting a lot of countries where people very keenly feel the expense of paying for staples in a way that here in the United States we've not really felt in a matter of decades. So when you have riots going on in places as distant as Egypt and as nearby as Mexico, and at the same time you have this outbreak of grain poaching going on in this country, or grain rustling, I believe is what they're describing it, where people who are farming wheat and oats and nuts, you know, pecans and walnuts out in California, where these staple foods are getting stolen, huge quantities are simply disappearing as people steal these because there is such an inflated price being paid for these staple foods. You know, we're seeing dynamics that lead the direction of some real catastrophic times, the likes of which Americans have not seen in generations.
And the average American, when you try to tell them this, they just sort of shrug. You know, we keep telling people, start laying in food, start laying in long-term food. I mean, get out of debt, you know, get your debts paid off, start putting your money into gold and silver. Understand we're heading into a crisis situation. We always stress the importance of a spiritual response as well. But certainly, you know, any logical person would be have food set aside just in case these things come to pass. And we've sent out literally thousands of catalogs and only got back a handful of responses. It's almost beyond my comprehension that people are not making preparations if they listen to our program.
Yeah. Well, beyond that, if you just take a look at how practically it's a good idea not to be dependent on your local grocery store, given the fact that the price trends are really, really bad. Just to give you one very quick anecdotal example, I go to a little town near Boise called Caldwell every Monday to tape some radio programs. I have to do that every Monday, and that means that every Monday I have to eat lunch outside the home. That's a little expense I'd like to forego, but that's just the way it works. I stopped at a little burger joint in a town called Parma, not far from where I am, and they had a little sign announcing that they could no longer afford to put tomatoes on their hamburgers. They said, we hope that's a temporary thing. But you take a look at that, and you take a look at the fact that due to the ever-escalating price of wheat, the price of buns is going up in hamburgers, so something has to go. And these are little dislocations that, in the aggregate, really mean a lot. You take a look at the fact that every time you go to the grocery store, bread has increased in price.
We're out of time. God bless you. Hang on there. We've got just a moment or two more to go. We'll go right ahead, William.
Yeah. I was saying that every time you go to the grocery store, you take a look at the fact that staple foods go up in price, and the increases in price are relentless. They're starting to provoke comment from people who are selling the merchandise at grocery stores. And when people on the other side of the cash register start complaining about what they're charging you, you know, things are getting a little bit dicey.
Right.
So just from a practical point of view, whether you think we're headed to a catastrophe or not, if you know how to make your own bread and can afford to go out and buy the wheat, it's a good idea to do it now before you can no longer afford to go out and do so, just because it's so much less expensive to make it yourself than to buy it at the grocery store. That's just simply a practical thing that is based on the way that the market signals are informing us about what's coming. So it just strikes me as completely ludicrous and irresponsible that people don't take advantage right now of the opportunities that you have at a time when the scarcity is pronounced and the expense is substantial, but both of those things will get worse, much worse, very quickly. They have to act right now. I went out and bought several hundred pounds of wheat a couple of weeks ago, and I was amazed how much I had to pay. But taking a look at the trend line, I think I did it at a better time than I would have encountered had I tried to do it, say, a week or two from now. Same thing where you're buying beans or other things that are long-term storage items. You can get decent prices on canned foods to get you by. You know, putting away a potable water in quantity is a good thing to do, not merely because if we have a real meltdown of the economy or we have a terrorist attack or some other catastrophe of that sort, you might end up not having water supplies. But just because it's a good idea to have that around. I mean, if people would have taken basic precautions of that sort in places where they're prone to floods or hurricanes or earthquakes, they'd be a lot better off. But all these things are just basic stewardship concerns that any intelligent person should be attending to. And particularly right now, when you take a look at the fact that the cancer has metastasized and we're dealing with what I honestly believe to be a terminal crisis of our financial system, you simply have to provide for the physical security of your family to the extent that it lies within you to do so. And this is reality. Reality is not optional.
I agree with you totally, and I think that people really have to start making their preparations, whether they get things through Radio Liberty or whether they get them at some other place.
Yeah.
I really don't care, but make your preparations. Understand that there really are people, of course, who intend to create a crisis in America, and out of that crisis will come the demand for the New World Order and the New World Religion and the New World Leader. And I think it's only a matter of time. Handwriting's on the wall. Government's lying to us about inflation. Inflation is really running 10 to 12%.
Mm-hmm.
And if you honestly believe that the core inflation rate is 2.1%, why, of course, you're incredibly naive. Good night, William. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope you enjoy our conversations with William. I think he's one of the most fascinating guests we have. Of course, we have a lot of fascinating guests, and this evening has been a great program with Constance Cumby and William Grigg. Well, let me simply suggest some of the things that you need to have to understand what's going on. We have a 4-tape set on oil. That's what it's called, oil. And, of course, there we interview a gentleman who's, at that time, several years ago, was in Washington, D.C., pleading with congressmen and senators to vote for a floor price of oil of $25 a barrel. And, of course, he represents oil producers who would go out, if they could be sure they'd get $25 a barrel for their oil, they would start drilling all over America. Why won't they drill now, whether it's $100 a barrel? Because they know very well if they do, why, of course, the oil companies will come back in and they'll drop the price of oil down to $10 a barrel and put all the oil producers out of business, as they've done repeatedly in the past. So they're pleading for a floor of $25 a barrel and we'd have oil, the oil we want. But they don't want you to know that. There's no shortage of oil. It's all artificially created by the... It used to be the Seven Sisters. Now, of course, it's the Five Sisters, five great oil companies that dominate the world. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on electricity. The phony electricities crisis, and this is the reason why your electricity is going up. We have a great syllabus on that. To understand the influence of the great tax exempt foundations, a book written 50 years ago this year, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, one of the five most important books in my library, going into the fact that the great tax exempt foundations for Rockefeller, Carnegie, financing communism and socialism, because, of course, they want to centralize all power in government. And then, of course, we carry Liberty and Eclipse. That's the book that was written by our guest. And then, of course, we have the book by Wayne Peterson, Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings. And, of course, it's on our special list, a special research list. But you'll find out that, of course, people from all over the world are going to Henderson, Nevada, waiting for the return of the Christ, Maitreya. And, of course, it's not Jesus Christ. It's not the Lord that we worship. But there is another God out there. And, of course, he is worshipped by literally millions of people. And when people say, I believe in God, the question is, what God do they really believe in? The God of the Bible or the other God, the God of the Gnostics? And you really need, of course, to get into Gnosticism. Certainly, Joe Schimmel has a wonderful DVD. It's called The Da Vinci Con. The Da Vinci Con, we recommend it because it'll explain to you a lot about the Gnostic religion. It is the most powerful religion in the world today, and it has millions and millions and millions of people who support it, and the Gnostic religion has infiltrated the Christian church, the Catholic church, the Jewish religion, and of course it is part of the old heresies going back to the time of the mystery religions and the secret societies of antiquity. So all of these things are available from Radio Liberty. Let me suggest my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, a good place to start. And then, of course, the DVD, The Forbidden Secret, along with the syllabus that goes with that, the CD or fourth tape set, The Secret Behind the Secret. We carry, of course, a four-tape set, a four-CD set on satanic crimes. And then there is a book that goes with that. You'll get into the influence of the Satanism within the Bilderberger group, a very, very powerful group. If you want to know what they do at the Bohemian Grove, we have a DVD on that. That's called The End Game. And then we have my four-tape set on the Bilderbergers. We have two books on the Bilderbergers, which is really an occult organization. One is called...